Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at PSIDiscs.com, PSIDiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and joining me in the studio this morning is my good buddy and co-host, Todd Schnick. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, Stone. How are you?
I am doing well, man. I'm a bachelor this week. I got my 13-year-olds in the Caribbean, and my wife's in London earning a paycheck, so I'm on my own. I foresee a couple of steak dinners this week.
Well, somebody ought to be earning a paycheck. That's good to hear.
So my 13-year-old comes to me. It's the afternoon of Christmas. And she gets a phone call from her buddy, and she says, Dad, I've been invited to a cruise in April. So me, I took a page right out of Dad's book, right? I said, oh, darling, you can go on a cruise if you want to, but you'll need to pay for it yourself. Mom and Dad are trying to, you know, juggle some finances. Now, in my world, when you tell a 13-year-old kid they can go on a cruise as long as they pay for it themselves, in my world, that's an elegant, well-played no. Am I right?
Typically, yeah.
I mean,
I know your daughter.
If your dad would have told you at 13 you could go on a cruise if you pay for it yourself, that was a no,
that
right?
That was code for no.
Well, she's in the Caribbean right now.
Yeah.
And she's going to be my financial manager.
Understood.
So what's going on with you, man? You're neck deep in running season, yeah?
Yeah,
marathons and stuff?
Training for the next race. This weekend was spent doing a lot of writing. I'm working on two books. I got a book proposal I'm working on, and then I'm working on the volume two of the 40 and 240 series, so... Starting to get that together. So it's
going to be a better book because I noticed I wasn't invited to write on that one.
Well, I wanted the thing to actually succeed this time.
A different caliber of input.
The first book was limited to Atlanta only friends of mine. So this one's right. Been opened up to the world. So a whole different audience.
Well, the first one was hugely successful.
Yeah.
I thought it was really well done.
I appreciate that.
Aside.
So that was my weekend. Was working on that, doing a little editing, the formatting.
Cool. So who'd you bring with you
this
morning?
Oh, my gosh. This is going to be a fun segment. I don't really know how to introduce this guy. He's a writer. He's an author. He's a blogger. Probably a sales agitator is a good way to describe him. welcome to the show, Danny Welchman.
Welcome.
So first of all, thank you for making the trek from Greenville, South Carolina this morning. That must have been fun.
It was delightful. 2.5 hours in my car is always fun.
Yeah. But you wrote a blog post en route down here. That was pretty cool. Tell the audience about that little tool that you're using.
Yeah, so I have Dragon on my BlackBerry, so as I'm driving, I just hit the button and start dictating, and of course it does wonderful things with making new words that I did not know existed, but it's fun. You know, 800 words later, I'm 2.5 hours closer to you.
Yeah, so that's awesome. So that's a tool I'm going to have to check out. You know, I don't even know where to start our conversation, Danny. You are obviously a guy who's way involved in providing sales thought leadership. I want to start off with a very simple, very gentle question. It seems to me most people in sales suck. Why is that?
It's a very gentle question.
Yeah.
Let's just take the easy ones this morning, huh?
Yeah.
Well, they do. The reason why they suck is because they do, right? I mean, we've built... this generational thing where we've made sales a process and we've forgotten about the people behind it. And it started in the 90s, right? In the 90s, we were all about this bipolar sense of I'm my office self at the office and then I come home and I'm my home self. And I actually think it's interesting that anecdotally, in the late 90s, we saw the biggest rise in pharmaceuticals around things like keeping us balanced, right? Really interesting. At the same time as we're teaching all this stuff. In the 2000s more specifically, we decided that we need to address the whole you. And then in 2010, we said results matter, but only the results that happen right now matter. And so we've created this really crazy neurotic industry where people are running around getting results now at any cost. We've forgotten about the people, what drives us emotionally. We've forgotten about just what drives the person on the other end of the table, and it's a sinking ship. And sadly, none of the industry experts are doing anything to help this. And I'm using none a little bit too harshly, but most of them are writing this boring stuff about trigger events and all kinds of business process change, and it's all mindless fluff, right? When, you know, when you reach down and grab the book, what changes deep in your soul? Nothing, right? There's not much change at all. And sadly, without change, it's all transactional. And what we need really in sales is transformation. And we're not seeing much of that. So that's a light answer to your very easy question.
So people write you checks to help them rethink all of this and get better at it and transform their own sales processes? Or how do you make the rent?
Oh, how do I make the rent?
Yeah.
Well, that's my wife's asking me. I help. I do try to help companies. You're right. I speak and I write and I consult, helping companies with unconventional thinking. And so my philosophy is that most of the reason why we fail is three reasons: conventional thinking, social peer pressure, and selfish behavior. If you look at selling as a craft, it's all built around selfish behaviors. You give me what I want first, and then I give you something. It's inherent selfish behavior. So what if we can move beyond selfish behavior? What if we can move beyond social peer pressure? Just because you have 2,000 friends on Facebook all jumping off the same cliff doesn't make that a cliff you want to jump off. And we're all happy to do it. Yeah, let's go do it. We're on Twitter, on Facebook. We're acting like lunatics, right? You know, there's no need to do this stuff. And there's nothing wrong with the tools either. They're platforms. There's nothing wrong with those tools. But the problem is that we haven't expanded our vision for using those things. We're still using the same selfish attitudes. And it just lets more people know how selfish we really are. It's like if you're a jerk in high school, back when I was growing up, you got pushed around by like the two or three people who were in your circle of friends, right? But now if you're selfish and you're on Facebook, there's only like 600 million other people watching you be an idiot, right? And so as sales guys, we haven't thought about these things. We haven't progressed our attitudes. We're about actions. And sadly, actions are a little bit too far down the line, right? So we need to come back upstream, think about philosophy, think about attitude, think about empathy, think about kindness, things like this. We've forgotten completely about kindness and gentleness in business. It's all about what can I get from me? And so we're really good at getting short-term results. And by the way, the list of the richest people just came out this week, right, on Forbes, I think, with all people paying. And there were five people that made more than $3 billion, all hedge fund managers this year. Of course, Paulson made $4.9 billion, right, all this, right? And I'm not saying those are bad people, but see, right, we link results to extravagance. And so we think of a sales guy drives a fancy car and wears a suit. He must be good at what he does. We may not know that he may be in that faking it stage rather than the making it stage, right? So I think we need to reprioritize. And as leaders, thought leaders, we need to take the stage and tell people it's not just how much you sell. It's how kind you are while selling.
You led a webinar last week on Focus.com, and were kind enough to invite me and another gentleman to join you as panelists. Our other colleague, Anthony Anarino, talked about the future of selling. What is your take, Danny, on the future of selling?
Well, you know, selling will continue, and despite a lot of people writing that selling is dead, selling's not dead. Like prostitution, it's one of those crafts that will never die.
Thank God for that.
I don't know what I'm thanking God for, but I'll just nod my head. And the people listening to this won't know which way I'm nodding it. You know, the selling changes, right? It morphs. And so we've seen Web 1.0. We saw Web 2.0. We're going to see Web 3.0 where it's data-centric. There's a lot more data that we're gathering. And so selling is going to head into this selling 3.0 phase 2. And I think it's going to be a lot like selling 2.0, which is we have more data at our fingertips. We're able to know what buyers want. Sadly, I think one of the things that Sales 3.0 is going to be more about is if the data can't justify that we sell to somebody that we don't. What I would encourage people to do is look beyond the data to the people. So we're very good at saying results matter, results. But really what we call results many times are just conclusions. And so there are conclusions, there are perspectives, there are thoughts. They're not really results per se. And so I think the future of selling is really people caring about other people. I think it's gentleness. It's not forcing results when there shouldn't be results. I think it's kindness. I think that's the future of selling, and I think you're going to see craftsmen stand up who can be kind, who could be manly men, but say, there's nothing wrong with being kind to someone else. I don't need to stab you in the back, or my father would say, even your friends in D.C. will stab you in the chest. no stabbing involved. You don't need to stab people to get ahead in business, right? So some of these archetypes that we have for what a successful business person is, right, we need to start rethinking. And sooner rather than later.
So your passion, your energy is so evident. I know it's coming over the airwaves, but I got to believe you didn't just wake up one morning and get so excited about this work. Tell me about the journey. How did you get into this, and what compelled you, and what got you to the point where you're this passionate about what you're doing?
Well, I had great parents. I did. I mean, I was raised by, like, the original Tiger Mom. So at 18 years old, I had spent 18 years of my life reading a book every day, playing the piano an hour every day, playing sports. I had no TV in the house. So
wow.
When I talk about Tiger Mom, like, I just look around and go, Tiger Woods was raised to play golf. I was raised to do business. And that analogy has kind of fallen out of favor recently, but I can't really think of another one to replace it. So you have to email me if you think of something better. But so at 18 years old, I went to college thinking, my dad was like, oh, it's going to be super hard, you know, study. So my first semester, this is how much of an idiot I am, unprepared for real life, I get a syllabi. And I'd gotten syllabi in high school. By the way, when I graduated a senior in high school, I was 6 seconds away from breaking the state record for running the mile. I was all national for playing soccer. I was like national speech champion and a science fair, third place in the nation for doing the granular motion of liquid particles or something like this. It was really crazy and nutty, but
I came in third place on that one.
Awesome. but I was really unprepared for real life. I got the syllabi. And so, I remember 2 weeks into the semester, I turned in all my homework. Literally. No joke. This is how nutty. I was unprepared for real life. I was in this really microcosm of high performance that my parents kindly suggested, although not so kindly, that I be a part of. And so I turned in all my homework, and the professor was like, what is this? And why are you giving this to me? And I was like, it's the assignments. When do I have more? And they were like, this is for the whole semester. So starting with my second semester in college, I never made that mistake. I did all my homework exactly the night before. But I went from that guy to just a high performer. I mean, but I was sadly misguided in a lot of things. I was prepared for running through walls, but I wasn't prepared for the emotional stability that I needed to really become an all-star. And so when I, you know, my first job, I took a company from $2 million to $20 million. 2 years, I left and took another company from a couple hundred thousand to millions of dollars, became the CEO, 25, expanded all across the country, blah, 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 grew the company, and I wanted to die. I did.
Because you weren't having fun?
I had tons of fun on the outside. I was known as Boy Wonder. I had tons of friends. I spent 30 years in D.C., so I've just moved to the South recently. But I had so much pain in my life. My marriage was a wreck because I would literally go into work on a Monday and come home on a Thursday. And I would just work like a ridiculous number of hours. I was training for an MMA fight. I was doing all of this stuff. Anything that was outrageous and extreme, jumping off of cliffs. I mean, just everything extreme. And so I just wasn't prepared emotionally. And so one night, I mean, my wife was like, I'm done. I'm done. This is ridiculous. And I was drunk, and I knew that I just did not want to live with this much pain in my life, really. And I knew either in a very real moment that I was either going to make a change or that I was going to stop everything. And I made a change. And now that I look back on it, I realize, man, I've made $50 million, right? It's a lot of money, but I could have had even more, you know, had I really changed my thinking and had I really been kind to people along the way. And I didn't brutalize anybody. All I did was run through walls. When had I been kind and gentler, I might have been able a team to help me run through walls. Right. So this changed my thinking. I started looking at everything differently. I started examining convention as I kind of disdained the ordinary. I said, if it's ordinary, I don't want any part of it. If it's mediocre, I'm going to call it out. And so this has now been, at 32, the next few years of my life, right, of helping people dig deep into the core of who they are and not just saying, I'm going to sell a process. If I follow all 7 steps, I'm going to be this masterful star. And we're churning out all these books and literature around this. And no one says, well, maybe the guy who got in a fight with his wife and kicked the cat on the way out to the car has problems that needs to be addressed that's going to stop him from following those 7 steps, right? So that's the type of stuff that I like to write about. That's the stuff I like to expose so that people start thinking, give themselves a chance to start thinking a little bit differently.
Dan, in your study and research on the whole sales process, you've spent a lot of time diving into like neuroscience and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, much of what we know about the brain, I mean, 90% of what we know about the brain is 4 or 5 years old. And in college, in university, after I left seminary, I went to study.
he just like throws that in there. After I left, you were in seminary?
I did. Yeah, I know. Of all things, right? You're like, who is this guy, and what is he doing in seminary? Yeah, I actually studied Greek theology.
Wow.
But I went to George Mason University, which our claim to fame now is a few years ago we made it to the Final Four, right? Yay.
Right.
Go Mason. But I studied government and international politics. So from God to government, not really sure that makes too much sense. But and then I went and studied mindfulness, was my human consciousness, was what I studied. That's where my spark started going. But the reason why I pursue this is in selling, we try to get in front of you and say, move your arm, move your arm, move your arm. However, right, it's convincing you, selling you to do something, to do something. We stand in front, we jump around like monkeys, and it's like, hey, do this thing. And we try to convince you and coerce you, manipulate you. I thought this. So if I walk up behind you with a safety pin and you don't see me and I poke you on the back of the arm, 99 out of 100 times you do the same thing. Like you swing your arm, right? You move your arm. You do exactly what you want. And you might hit me. You might swear at me or something like that. But you do what I want you to do. You move your arm. So my thought process is, what if I could stimulate you, trigger you to move your arm without having to convince you to move your arm? And then I began to realize that it's all in your brain anyways. And most people don't know how their brains work, right? But so I began to study and research. Now I'm a nut job. I'm reading all these scientific papers. And my wife's like, put them away, you know? There's other stuff to do. But yeah, so that's what I study is how chemically does the brain work and how does it cause you to do what you do. I mean, if I touch the stove, right, or if I touch a hot stove, 0.03 of a second before I ever move my hand away from the stove, my brain has already said, that's hot, you need to move. I start moving away before I even realize it. I've got 0.02 of a second, right? So 0.05, 0.03 of it is telling my brain to move. I have 0.02 to stop my brain or stop my hand from actually doing that. That's such little time. You have to be so mentally strong to stop yourself from doing things. It's why most of us struggle with stopping bad habits, because our inhibitors, the things that stop us from doing things, even if it's hurtful to ourselves, are the weakest parts of our brain. Right? So just things like that. So if that's the case, if our inhibitors are weakened, we really don't spend a lot of mental strength on inhibiting ourselves from doing things, how can we inhibit ourselves, right? Uninhibit ourselves, whatever the opposite of that is. I'm struggling for words right now. Help. No, whatever. Yeah. So, but I mean, why don't we factor to our strengths? Why don't we play to our strengths, right? So these are some of the things that we help people do. So you were asking earlier, Stone, about what I do for companies is imagine going into a company and helping them rethink what they do. I mean, imagine, I mean, if I would have told you 10 years ago, we're going to start a business, Stone, me and you, and we're going to create a company for women where we're going to have shoes. It's going to be shoes. It's going to be a mad mall of shoes. And women can come to our shoe store online. They can pay us. We're going to send them shoes. They're going to pay for 3-day shipping, and we're going to send it overnight. And we're not even going to charge them for it. Shocker. And then they're going to get these shoes. They can walk around for a full week on them. They can go to a wedding, go to the prom, go to the mall. Who cares? Go out with their friends. And if they don't like the shoes, they can send them back to us, and we're going to refund all of their money. 10 years ago, I would have been laughed out of this room, right?
Yes.
But Zappos built a $1 billion company out of kindness. That exact same thing, that's exactly what they did. So why can't other companies do it? Why can't other companies be the next Zappos? Why can't we lead with kindness?
Why can't you sell that way?
So many people don't sell that way. Well, they don't sell that way because we're fearful. We're fearful that if we're kind, we're going to get rejected. We're fearful that if we give, that someone's going to take, and we're going to be hurting inside. And guess what? Yeah. It happens. Grow up, right? I mean, we had moms telling us this stuff when we were 5 years old. All of a sudden, we get 25 and 35 and 45, and we suddenly forget that some of the core lessons of life still apply. It's a little bit of ridiculous behavior. I mean, look. The older we get, my son is 3 years old. He licks anything off the floor. I mean, he's a nut job, right? But me, I'm like germophobic. I don't even want to get next to this microphone. I mean, who knows who's been breathing on this thing, you know? Right? But we get older, we get silly, you know? It's our brain. It's the part that says, if it's new, I fear it, right? And that did a wonderful purpose for our ancestors 10,000 years ago, who were walking through the jungle and they saw the tall grass move. They got the hell out of there, right? Because it was a saber-toothed tiger ready to bite their head off. Nowadays, we're acting that same way. We go into work with our spears and our shields on, right? We go to battle and we start seeing the grass move and we start running. There's no tiger there, right? There's no tiger. It's silly. It's 2011, but we're still acting in the same behaviors that if it's new and I don't understand it, the first thing I do is I'm afraid. And that fear drives everything else that I do. And really, it's a lot of illogical behaviors.
Dan, important follow-up question. Does your wife study neuroscience to try to understand you?
My wife and I, who are actually, I was interviewed, someone asked me, what's your biggest success? I said that I'm still married to a wonderful woman who's put up with all my crap now for more than 7 years, seven or eight.
God bless her.
Yes, she's a saint. But no, she just tries to keep me on top of my game.
Well, I think she's doing a marvelous job. Listen, how can our listeners find out more about your work, get in touch with you, and maybe have a substantive conversation with you about coming in and helping them revisit, rethink their operation, man?
So what I generally say to people this is, you don't want to pay me for anything. You don't need to. Just go to danwaldschmidt.com. I've got tons of material there that's free. I write a blog that the Wall Street Journal says is one of the top blogs in the world. I only say that to say I take time and energy to try to write substance. I'm not selling you anything. I don't work with people. I work with companies. So if you're a people listening, just go to the site and get everything you can for free. There's books there. They're all for free. There's ebooks and a lot of great content, and I'll connect with other people like my good buddy Todd here, and just get as much as you can. There's no one selling you anything. It's a safe zone for not selling you anything.
No tigers in the grass on
your website. No tigers in the grass here. Right.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you on the show. I hope you'll come back sometime and share some more stories with us, maybe bring a client or something. It's been a blast, man. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. And next time I come, I want to be able to stand up, though.
Okay, you got it. I am standing up.
Yeah, Stone is standing up, so...
Hey, listen, can you hang out with us for a little while we visit with our next guest?
Sure.
Terrific. Well, I'm wore out, Todd. I don't know.
Okay.
Listening to that guy, I don't know. But, what an energetic, fun, informative interview. And the kudos go to you. You're the one that booked him, right?
Yeah.
Nicely done.
He paid me a nice sum. So.
Well, next up on the High Velocity Radio Show, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce two ladies from Jackson and Spalding. Welcome to the show, Caroline Duffy and Stephanie Sanders.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, we are so glad that you're here, and I'm glad you had an opportunity to listen in on that interview. Stephanie, you and I are the ones that sort of put this together. How about giving us a little bit of a feel for Jackson Spalding and what you guys are out there doing for folks?
Sure. Well, I've been at Jackson Spalding for just 4 months now, so I'm still pretty new, and Caroline should probably jump in if I can't describe everything we do. But we're a PR firm in town. We're one of the biggest private firms in the Southeast, or maybe nationally. Mm-hmm. We also have offices in Athens, Georgia, and Dallas. And what I'm there to do is build our social PR business. So what that means is... for clients who are already with us, of course, with, you know, traditional PR communications and marketing and things like that, you know, we're helping them integrate social into their existing plans and, practically speaking, you know, getting their website, getting their channels, their newsrooms up to date, but also helping them pay attention to their storytelling, kind of like what Dan was saying, story mining, content strategies, and really thinking about their news from a storytelling perspective and not just, you know, putting the old hard news out there, just blah, out on their Twitter feed, out on their Facebook page, and, you know, not even paying attention to it again, but really taking that time and energy and effort to say something of substance and, you know, get people talking about it, sharing it, responding to them about it, and then following back up with them and creating that real relationship with the people that they're trying to talk to.
So did you come in and sell Caroline and that crowd on this whole social PR thing? Or Caroline, did you go out and you knew this is what you were after and you found it?
Well, social PR, social media is the fastest growing part of our business, probably anybody's business. And so we knew more than a year ago that this is a direction that we really wanted to go in. And we're also busy. We needed somebody that could help guide us and move it along. And we looked for a long time. We interviewed a lot of people, and we were thrilled to find Stephanie. She has an academic background and was in PR earlier in her career, but has been doing a lot of social media prior to joining us with Georgia Tech. And so we were thrilled when she joined us, and she's already making a big difference.
Ladies, when organizations are now saying, okay, I don't think the social media thing is a fad. We probably ought to invest some energy in it. But yet still way too many of them use it as the one-way broadcasting tool. How do you change that internal thinking that most organizations still seem to embrace?
Well, I'm going to let Stephanie take most of this, but I would say it's here to stay. It's, as I said, the fastest growing part of our business, and you've got to jump in and you've got to learn to be comfortable. There's a little bit of risk, but a lot of reward if you play the game right. And
Yep. Well, when I have been talking to clients about this, I tell them, if you don't have the time to put into this, then you shouldn't be doing it. And I'm not sure if my bosses love that I, you know, try and turn away business like that. But I really believe that it takes time and attention. And in PR today, as I've experienced it, there is not a lot of time to put into the storytelling. It's just, we got to get this news out and we got to move on to the next thing. And it's really fast paced. And we're kind of losing that, you know, the public relations part of PR, kind of the whole thing. So that's, you know, if they don't have the time, if they don't have the resources, if they don't have the support, if they won't think of creative ways to fund some of the basic things they need to do, it doesn't have to be the $1 million campaign. It just has to be doing the basics right, refining it, you know, watching how it goes and building on top of that.
But I talk to all my clients and say, all right, you've got to engage on the social web. But they don't understand that. They think, oh, it's just another way, another vehicle for me to push out a message.
Right.
When it's, you know, people say, Todd, I'm never going to sell a $20,000 piece of consulting on Twitter. I said, no, you're not. But you're going to initiate a conversation. You're going to start a dialogue. Why do organizations struggle to get that through their mind and their mindset? I just don't understand it.
I think they're just so used to that one-way conversation.
Yeah,
it's been
right.
going on for decades, and you know that's all they know. And you know, maybe somebody's in their 30s or 40s or 50s and doesn't want to learn this newfangled way that has changed everything, and they're tired and they just want to go home at the end of the day. And this is, you know, something very new and it's totally changing the game. And it's just maybe exhausting to think about, but it's also a must.
And I think it's the consumer companies that are moving ahead more quickly than the B2B. And as people see how well that's going for companies like Chick-fil-A, for example, where you can build a passionate fan base online and get that feedback right away that you can react to, they're getting more comfortable as the leaders get out there and participate in social.
Well, as Dan said, it's okay to be kind and
yeah.
help people and all that. Why do these organizations not understand that you can use these social tools to do just that? I mean, it boggles my mind that they just can't seem to get a handle on that, you know. So that's why organizations need people like us just to help them understand that.
Now, are you allowed to share some of your clients that you're working with? And if not, can you maybe just share some anecdotes, some stories of some things you guys are doing with them and for them?
Sure. Well, let's see. Primrose Schools is a major client of ours.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. So they're doing some really progressive and sophisticated things with social media, I think. I mean, you know, basic corporate blog, but they really, really put that time into the storytelling. They spend a lot of time researching their posts, and we help them with that, and writing about the actual science behind child rearing and childhood education from, you know, just newborn up to, I guess, about maybe 3 years old, which is their age range that they concentrate on. They also have this, I guess, annual event called the Family Dance Off, which, you know, I think is a way to, you know, get their name out there, of course, and spend time engaging with their families and giving a way for their families to spend time together. So it's a very creative use of technology that doesn't really cost them much. It's, you know, families do a dance and upload the video and, you know, then it's judged and they, you know,
how
they win something.
That?
Yeah, it is really fun. We've got several blue chip companies that are all doing a variety of things. I can't really name names there, but, you know, they're integrating social with their crisis plans, which is something everybody should be doing at this point.
Well, you mean when something goes wrong, they're
right.
using the social.
Right. We're working with them. You know, they, of course, you know, have, you know, a crisis situation protocol, you know, the big, thick red notebook of what to do when something
right,
horrible
right.
goes wrong. And now they're working with us to integrate social along every, you know, touch point, communication point,
yeah.
getting the information out, that kind of thing. Who else? We've got Caroline. Help me out here.
Well, when you mentioned Primrose, it's been a little while for me. I've got a 13-year-old and an 18-year-old, but I can think if I'm shopping preschool and I go on that website, and instead of just jumping up and down, pick me, and let me tell you how great and wonderful we are and all that stuff, if you have some genuine thought leadership, and it sounds like there's thought leadership on there that talks about preschool education, to me that provides a level of credibility.
Right.
That makes me feel good and makes me want to say, okay, I'm putting these guys on the short list. Is that that's a conscious, you didn't just trip over that. You consciously are doing that.
Exactly. And that's another thing we talk to clients about. And we've got several clients that talk about, well, we need to know the ROI before we start this. Mm-hmm. Well, you need a baseline at least to start with. And then, you know, of course, there are things that you can track, you know, direct sale numbers, of course. But there's a lot about the relationship factor that goes into getting to that sale. So we have to spend a lot of time having that conversation. With something like the family dance-off, I'm not sure anybody's signing up or enrolling is, you know, just because they've participated in this, but right. they certainly are going to get a lot of great word of mouth. You know, they can certainly look at, you know, did enrollments, you know, kind of go up over the 6 months or a year over time after that campaign happened. It, you know, it, there's definitely a set of metrics you have to look at for, you know, sales ROI. So we kind of concentrate on that at Jackson Spaulding, too, when we talk about measurement.
I detest the ROI question.
I know. It's so
I'm like, well, okay, well, then what's the ROI of building an evangelist for your company?
Mm-hmm. Oh, although yeah. I think that, you know, social gives us a great opportunity to measure better than a lot of the other things that...
Why don't they understand that?
And so it's
absolutely.
Just, I think it's just an evolving thing, you know, and it's evolving quickly.
Oh, you're right.
I used to lead the Delta Airlines business, and I remember the Flyer Talk community. If you guys are frequent flyers, you know, it's a very active chat community. And, you know, initially, they really didn't know what to do about that, but now they're diving in and doing a great job staying in touch with their flyers, understanding and sometimes hearing from their passengers about things that are happening.
Lots
throughout
of
the
aggregated
system.
Flyers out there.
And, you know, it's really
it's a very active community.
It's a wonderful way to build a passionate community. And one of the things that we try to help them understand is if you know, the bigger you are, you're going to face a crisis at some point. And if you've got a passionate community behind you, they will raise you up when things happen and they will defend you and can be the most powerful marketing out there.
Another challenging question I suspect you guys get, because it's what I get from my clients, is, okay, Todd, I get that I ought to be investigating energy into this, but I don't know how I'm going to generate all this content.
That is
you
a
know,
big
and you talk about the storytelling. I mean, if they don't understand the value of storytelling in marketing, well, then they got bigger issues. But so how do you, what are the first steps you guys employ to help a client who says, all right, I'm willing to get into this, but I don't have the first clue how we're going to generate the amount of content this is going to take?
Well, as Stephanie said, they do have to be committed to the channel, and it's you know, if you're going to be in it, you're going to have to be in it, and that's sometimes where we come in. You know, we can speak in the voice of the client and help generate that content for their approval, and so that's one way that it works. And then we have clients that are generating content and making time for it, so it just depends on their philosophy.
Or you could interview people like Dan Waldschmidt and just get some really unique content to share just that
That's
way.
That's right.
Well, I'll give you an example from our own company. We started a blog a few years ago, JS Think Stand, and initially we thought that our management team would be the bloggers. And we quickly discovered that we needed a lot of content all the time, and so we opened it up to our entire company, and it's been a great opportunity.
That's the key.
Yeah.
Everybody in that organization from top to bottom is a creative.
And I'll
they
tell
need
you,
to be empowered to do that.
And I think what's really interesting to me right now is that social media is really making companies have to think about their culture. Mm-hmm. And that's something we've always done very well at Jackson Spaulding, fortunately. But that's a lesson that we're having to take out to the corporate world, that it's no longer a one-way conversation. They're going to be having that conversation about their workplace or about the organization, whether you like it or not. So you better be taking care that you're building the right kind of culture so that your brand ambassadors are saying the things that you want them to say. So I think that's a big opportunity for those of us in public relations today, is to help companies with their internal culture building.
Stephanie, I get the sense that you could have named your own ticket. Why were you attracted to Jackson Spaulding? Why them instead of what were surely a lot of other really great alternatives for you?
Well, I feel like I've spent my career kind of figuring out the right balance of kind of traditional communications and digital communications. And my degrees are in mass communications, advertising, and PR. And you know, I went to UGA, one of the top journalism schools, and I loved creative writing, and I loved the creative side of advertising, and thought that that was kind of the direction I was going to go. But then I learned how to build a website somewhere in 1994 or 1995, and I just loved it. I just fell in love with the, I guess, the methodical building of something and the kind of code trance that you could get into and
code
then watch.
Trance. Yeah, I like that. I'm going to steal that.
And then, you know, and then just watch something come together online. And I was just, you know, I was fascinated with the World Wide Web, and it was a very exciting time in school and for me. And I, you know, I ended up building the first Snapper Lawnmowers corporate site for free. It was terrible. I apologize to this day, but I built it, and I was just so proud of that and excited by it. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to, you know, I want to go do web development. And that was kind of like my first job out of grad school. And I quickly learned that working in web development and, you know, software implementations was fun as a hobby and not necessarily as a full-time job. And I missed that creative side of communications. And so I spent many years, you know, going, you know, more towards PR, more towards technical, until I found this spot kind of, you know, when I went to Georgia Tech, I was director of communications. So I had this whole plan that I was in charge of, and it was from media relations to social to, you know, everything else we were doing online and marketing. And, you know, that was really exciting. And that's where I really learned how to put it all together. Integrated marketing communications is, you know, hopefully what everybody is doing by now. And then, you know, after feeling like I did everything I could do, I thought, I really want to focus on the digital again, because we're at another point with social media that we were in the 90s, which when I, you know, first fell in love with digital, like, this is new. This is going to be very exciting. I want to, like, be at the forefront of it. And, you know, so I started looking around, and, you know, I had some friends at Jackson Spaulding, and it was very much a friendly conversation. They brought me in, and it just seemed like the fit work, the chemistry, our personalities,
the
culture.
That is so important. So what kind of mistakes do you find that these companies, even the blue chips all the way across the board, what kind of mistakes do they make if they don't have the benefit of counsel from somebody like you and Jackson and Spaulding?
Well, sometimes I feel like the strategic decision-making isn't driven by data or research, and I'm really into that. I kind of learned that at Georgia Tech, the value of, you know, the background research, and so I really try and make sure that there is a business basis for the strategic decisions for communications that we're making. And then, you know, once the campaign or the project or whatever runs, it needs to be followed up with measurement. And I put, for example, you know, measurement plans, small ones if they need to be, in every proposal that we send out. Even if the client doesn't want to move forward with it for whatever reason, you know, we are always telling them, this is important. And if you're going to call us on it later for it not working, then we can blame it
on
you.
Well, and the technology, these platforms really lend themselves to real-time measurement, right? Which is great.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
My hat's off to you, though, because I'm just going to say it. A lot of other PR shops out there, they've brought this they've added this line item to the letterhead because, well, we got to be there. But they just use it as another vehicle to distribute one-way messaging. So I hats off to you guys for obviously making it a very clear priority as a conversational tool.
Something that may be really interesting to the listeners is how to behave in a crisis online. And I think Stephanie could talk a little bit about that. But, you know, you don't go dark if you've had an online persona out there. You have to keep it going even during the tough times. But that's when you win those customers. So do you want to talk about that a little bit, just about crisis?
Yeah, please. Right. I want to hear about that. And I love that. That's good. So you can't go dark, right?
Right.
But
right.
We want to, right? That's our first instinct.
Well, I've heard plenty of times that somebody doesn't want to answer the negative sentiment out there because they don't want to fuel the fire. And that is just the wrong way to do it. If it was a personal relationship and you upset a friend, you wouldn't just be quiet and drop that friend and let them stew about it. You would, you know, kind of reach out, hopefully, and say,
Dan's, you know, looking at me from across the studio saying, I don't know, I might.
Let's talk about it. Let's resolve it. I value this relationship more than, you know, I guess my ego or my pride,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And I feel like it's the same exact thing online. If you have a detractor, you know, they've had an experience with you that they are not happy with. If it's legitimate, you need to deal with it. You know, these are the people that, this is why you're in business. This is why you have a job. So you just need to talk to them like a human. I'm sorry this happened. What can we do to help? I mean, you know, they're also people who go on, you know, huge rants, and they're not really legitimate. So you got to work that stuff out. There's a level of assessment, but if somebody has, you know, genuine criticism or if they had a bad experience, you absolutely have to go out there and answer it, if for no other reason than for the fact that it lives there forever and that it will show what kind of integrity and character your company has, that you've gone out and, you know, cared for your customer.
Care is the key word. Mm-hmm. That's all the audience needs. That's all the public needs to see, is that you're engaged and you're visibly trying to do something about the problem.
Right.
You know, and the marketplace knows about the nuts. There are people out there that get off on causing trouble. But the significant majority of people out there understand that there's some outliers. Mm-hmm. And so just being visible is really the key to diffusing that. And I think it builds longer term loyalty of those people.
Absolutely.
I think another message about social marketing today is, you know, the media is diminishing. And it's a chance to own your content and not go through the filter of the media. So that's a huge plus for companies to be able to speak in their own voice and to say what they want to say when they want to say it. So that's another aspect of it that people need to understand.
Well, I definitely want these folks in our corner, if Business Radio X or High Velocity.
It's a crisis communication out of the two of us. So.
They're not going to put me in charge of crisis communication. I can tell you that for a fact. Two things before we let you go. One, I want to make sure that our listeners know how to get in touch with you so they can learn more and talk with you. Also, I just want to pitch an idea, and we'll talk about it more offline, but I think it would be a really strong show to have you guys come back and bring a client. And talk through, you know, actually walk through an engagement. Would you guys maybe be up for that sometime?
We'd love to do that.
All
yeah.
right.
Absolutely.
We'll make
yeah.
that happen. So how can our listeners get in touch with you?
Well, for me, Stephanie, you can find me on Twitter. It's Stephanie Says. It's spelled STEF as in Foxtrot, ANYSAYS, or email ssanders@jacksonspalding.com.
And I'm CNDuffy@jacksonspalding.com, and we have a website, you know, jacksonspalding.com, and that's me.
Well, I like it. You know what? I'm going to do Stone Says instead of Stone Paint. That's kind of cool, right?
Well, you know, it's actually kind of a ripoff of a Velvet Underground song called Stephanie Says. I'm not sure if anybody's gotten it yet, but that's where I got it.
Our producer just did a thumbs up, so he knew all about it. Well, thanks again for joining us. Can you hang out for just a little while longer? We got
sure.
one more interview.
Sure.
Okay. Well, bringing it home for us today on the High Velocity Radio Show is a gentleman with Endurance Strategies, Andres Sundante.
Congratulations. You got that one right.
I looked at him for approval that I said that last name right.
The eyebrows raising whenever I say my name and people look at me and smile. I said, that's terrific. Just call me Andy. It's a lot easier.
Well, thank you.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. You've been very patient, but I think you've had the pleasure of listening to two really great interviews.
I was going to say, I feel like I've gotten about an hour of free consulting. I'm listening here to Dan talk about sales and Jackson Spalding team here. It's just really been a delight. I'm sure your listeners have enjoyed the show.
Well, and that's why we do this show, because it's all the free consulting.
It's
trust
free
me,
consulting.
It's the only reason.
I think I'll come back if I'm invited back. So.
Absolutely.
You saved me for last. I hope not, because my business is the most boring.
It was easier to edit out
services, but
well,
the
let's
last
figure
interview
out a way
is easier to edit out, right?
Yeah, right.
So tell us about Endurance Strategies. What do you guys do?
Well, Endurance Strategy is a company that I started in May of 2010, so we're coming up on our first anniversary, and we're based here in Atlanta. Endurance Strategies is a third-party marketing and placement firm. People look at me and say, so what do you do?
So what does that mean?
What does exactly that mean? We are a representative that's hired by an investment manager. So think about, a typical client for us would be a hedge fund. And a hedge fund is really just a legal partnership. The general partner would be the hedge fund managers. They're the people that are managing the money. And they are looking for limited partners, which would be investors. Typically, these hedge fund types, I call them hedgies, they couldn't sell themselves out of a wet paper bag. They're very, very talented at the investment process, and they're very, very good at the analytical part of the business. But in terms of articulating what it is that they do and explaining it in very simple, concise terms to folks scares them. So where we come in, Endurance Strategies, is a third-party marketer. So we're an intermediary between the hedge fund manager and the end investor. And those end investors vary from accredited high-net-worth individuals, the SEC and FINRA, my big boy regulators, basically say that you cannot invest in a hedge fund unless you're accredited. And that means that you have $1 million of liquid net worth, excluding your primary residence. So we really start with high net worth individuals, and we move up from there. It could be foundations. It could be university endowments, fund of hedge funds who invest in underlying managers, pensions. Many of us work at companies that either have a pension plan. If not, they've eliminated it. So those are some of the investors that we go out and target on behalf of the managers.
So hedge, tell me about the hedge and the term hedge fund. I've never, what are they hedging against?
Yeah, so the business is probably about 60 years old. Hedge funds, for what we know them today, were started by a gentleman who was actually a journalist with Fortune magazine back in 1949. Alfred Winslow Jones started the first, what is now known as a hedge fund. He was investing in stocks, and he said, instead of investing in stocks and just expecting them only to go up, I could protect some of my downside by buying some positions in some companies that I expect their price of their stock will go down, and that creates a hedge. And so from that, the concept of trying to create investment strategies where you allow yourself to get the upside of the market, but you protect the downside, that's in a very simple definition how hedge funds came to be. And certainly now, over the last 60 years, there's been an explosion in the industry. Really? As of the fourth quarter of 2010, assets under management for probably about 9,000 to 9,500 hedge funds around the world stood at just under $2 trillion. So there's been a pretty explosive growth trajectory, certainly in the last 3 to 4 years with where the market has been. You saw the assets under management come down a bit. But I expect that when numbers come out for the first quarter of 2011, that we'll eclipse the all-time high of $1.93 trillion of assets under management.
Well, and now Todd Schnick knows what one is, so now you've got access to his pockets.
Yeah, it's an interesting business. They're complex investments. There are certainly things that if folks are interested, they need to talk with their tax and financial advisor and their attorney. But really, if you think about our business, Endurance Strategies, we are sort of a voice. A lot of the things that we've talked about this morning having to do with messaging and, trying to sort of get through all the noise. That's really what we do at the end of the day.
But it is a complicated thing to try to understand. I mean, let's be honest. A heavy majority of the populace has no idea what this stuff is or how it works, and will probably never do so, but probably because they don't have the resources to play in that sandbox. But how do you simplify that message? And I recognize you're targeting a specific audience. It probably is a little bit more savvy to that. But how do you do that? What tools do you use? Are you creative? Are you doing creative writing? What are you doing? Social media? How do you tell that story?
Yeah, it's a great question, Todd. Really, what it comes down to is stepping back and trying to think about what would be the optimal way for you to tell your story. If you were going out in front of accredited investors, institutional investors, what would you try to tell them very simply about what you do? What I do is I come in and help them to sort of craft a story. And this is all about storytelling at the end of the day. It's really no different than any other business. It's just that there are some more complexities and a few more zeros behind some of the things we're talking about. But at the end of the day, what I do is come in and we'll start with basic things. They're collateral material. If you think about a typical hedge fund, some of the things that they've got to do is they've got to
charts, graphs, numbers.
It's their pitch book. It's the collateral material that they use. It's the look of and feel and touch of the website. It's, are they getting exposure in the media? Are they speaking at conferences where thought leadership in the community, in the hedge fund community, are active? So it's a matter of helping them craft a good story, making it consistent, making sure that they're saying the things they're allowed to say. There's a lot of compliance and regulations. So they need a lot of help with that. We start with the look and feel. So we want to make sure that they look and feel institutional. What that means is if a guy is running a hedge fund here in Atlanta with $100 million under management, I want to help him look and feel like he's $1 billion assets under management. Yeah. And there are ways that we do that. We get them in front of the right people. We help them articulate their message. And it's all about creating an edge for them.
I was going to ask you about the compliance issues. I mean, if you go to any standard networking meeting, there's always a financial planner that gets up, and they're the most god-awful marketers I've ever And you want to go help them.
I agree.
You want to go help them and say, but they're so restricted in what they can and cannot say, and they have to use the existing marketing platform from their organization. How do you work around some of those challenges?
Well, yeah, that's a great question, and it's certainly top of mind. There's a lot of new regulation coming out with the Dodd-Frank Act, which for you know, for listeners, is basically all the legislation as a result of the financial crisis we've gone through in our country in the last 2 or 3 years. And it's certainly having a tremendous impact on my business. I think the best way to answer that is some of the things that we've talked about over the last 45 minutes. It's making it personal. So much of the financial services industry has gotten sort of a black eye, some deservedly so, because they were out selling product instead of trying to deliver solutions. And when you're out in the marketplace, I don't care who you're talking to, if you're just selling products, it makes that interaction that you're describing, that you've probably experienced or somebody's described to you, one in which it just makes your hair crawl on your neck. So what I try to do is certainly make it much more of a personal interaction. And that's not about selling. That's about getting to know somebody's issues, the challenges that they're facing, trying to understand their situation, because these products that I'm talking about are not for everybody. And so one of the things that I focus on, and one of the things that I think the financial services industry in general is doing a better job of, and you know, certainly made its share of mistakes, is thinking about clients in a partnership type fashion. And those are some of the things that companies are focused on. Regulation is probably going to help that. But from a personal marketing standpoint, my approach has always been, I can't lead with the products that I represent. I have to lead with who I am, the solutions that I want to bring forth to potential investors and to my clients at the end of the day. And that process takes time. It doesn't happen immediately. And some people are just not patient. So they typically don't become clients of mine.
So how did you get into this racket?
Well, I wouldn't use the word racket.
I wouldn't use the word racket, but you get where he's coming.
But I do understand the question. Well, my background, I did my MBA when I was over in Italy. I lived in Venice for 3 years and did an international MBA program. And
cool.
After I finished my MBA, I knew I wanted to get into financial services. But given where the market was, and given that I had been living in Europe for 3 years, I didn't exactly have a job awaiting me when I came back. Met my wife while I was there, and she and I decided to move to Florida, got into an outside sales job. I really felt like I needed to be in a position to go out and build a network and add value for clients. From that, I started applying for jobs in the financial services industry and ended up getting a position at SunTrust here in Atlanta. So my wife and I moved here in 2006, started with SunTrust, Robinson Humphrey, in their corporate investment bank, worked there, and then took a job at Regions Capital Markets, which is part of Regions Financial. So spent the last 4.5 years in financial services, and then through a twist of fate, was let go from Regions in October of 2009, and for the first time in my life, had to think about, you know, what do I want to do? What do I want to do when I grow up? And from that, the company Endurance Strategies came to be in May of 2010, and we're off to the races. It's a challenging time in the financial services industry. We've all gone through our share of challenges, probably being entrepreneurs or running businesses. Mine's no exception, but I'm certainly optimistic.
The economy seems to be beginning to lurch itself out of its doldrums. What does the next 10 years look like in the hedge fund industry?
I think there'll be a lot of growth in our industry. If you look at where a lot of the flows of assets into the hedge fund industry are coming from, they're coming from large institutional investors, pension funds. Pensions historically have been slow to move the ship, if you will. Endowments and foundations have been into hedge funds now for, you know, decades. Some of them are 30, 40, 50% of their portfolio are allocated to alternative investments, which hedge funds would be included in. Pension funds over the last 2 to 3 years have been the biggest allocator, we call it, to hedge funds, and that's not going to probably change much. 95 to 99% of the flows into hedge funds in the last 2 years have gone into $5 billion hedge funds or larger.
Wow.
Which creates a tremendous opportunity for my business, because I will represent firms that are smaller than that who really do need to have an advocate in the marketplace. They need to have somebody who can get out and tell their story, who can keep the message from going dark, to use, you know, something that the folks at Jackson and Spalding were talking about. So I'm very bullish on the industry, extremely excited. There's a lot of work to do, but, you know, there's no dull moment.
Well, I am so glad that Regions freed up your future a few years back, and we now have the benefit of your counsel here. I got to ask you, what you do strikes me as incredibly rewarding work, especially when it goes right. Yeah. What do you find particularly rewarding about the work, and what do you find a little bit challenging if not downright frustrating sometimes?
Yeah, I'll take the latter of those first. The challenging part is explaining to people what it is that I do. You know, it's explaining why do I need to listen to you? Why should I take a meeting with you? In the Southeast, if you think about Atlanta, large, 5.5 million people, going to grow, certainly. Many Fortune 500 companies, very, very successful businesses at all levels. But the typical non-financial services professional, particularly those inside of alternative investing and hedge funds, they don't really know what hedge funds are. So one of the things that I have to do constantly is remind myself to step back and educate and inform and be an advocate for our business, because we've had our share of black eyes in the third-party marketing world. But being a registered, affiliated with a great broker-dealer and doing everything the right way, which is the way I'm growing my business, it takes more time and there's a lot more education, but I do feel like there's more long-term reward. The first question about why, what gets me excited every day to get up and do it is that there's a hunger and there's a passion that people who run, run these funds bring to the business every day, and that's what gets me excited, is representing people who live and breathe, what it is that they do. And so I meet terrific people that are doing things the right way. The media doesn't always portray that necessarily fairly. There's probably 9,000 hedge funds out there. 80% of them aren't very good. 20% of them are. And that 20% are the ones that I aspire to work with and represent, because those are the ones that are going to grow in the next 10 years.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I was glad to be here.
Did you learn anything, Todd? Are you ready to invest in a hedge fund?
Yeah, absolutely. I have the cash available for it.
I know you do. You spend a little time in the radio business. You're just rolling in it.
Oh, absolutely.
You can't help it.
That's right. Oh, what a great episode today.
Oh, yeah, fun stuff. Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, our guest this morning, and everyone here at the Radio X family. We'll see you in the fast lane.